When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Welcome back, Crossover NBA Podcast. Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. And Howard, we have a guest on the Tuesday episode this week. That is a rarity. Usually the one-on-one interviews are under your umbrella on Fridays. This week, Kevin Love of your Cleveland Cavaliers joins me on the show a little bit later on. So I am encroaching onto your territory, my friend.
No, I'm excited for this, actually. Kevin Love, like one of the better kind of subtle under-the-radar stories of the season, right? Because we keep thinking about a Cavs revival, but there's been a Kevin Love revival, and you think about all that he's been through, bridging the LeBron era to whatever this new emerging era is and all the stuff in between and some really weird moments for him besides. So I can't wait to hear your chat with Kevin Love.
Yeah, we got into some of that, kind of the revival of Kevin Love, specifically as a sixth man and what that could mean for the rest of his career in terms of expanding his career and letting him play even deeper into his 30s. So stick around for that a little bit later in the show. I want to start this week, Howard, talking about the Lakers. And this may be the final time this season that we discuss the Los Angeles Lakers. By Wednesday night, they could be eliminated from the play-in picture, which is a remarkable thing to say, given that 10 teams make the playoffs in the Western Conference, or at least make the play-in in the Western Conference, and the Lakers are poised not to be one of them. There's a couple things I want to unpack here, Howard. One is this idea that the Lakers' season was derailed because of injuries. We've started to hear this narrative a lot. Kevin Durant brought it up in reference to Brooklyn and how his knee injury kind of derailed the Nets season. And there's some argument to be made there. Anthony Davis brought this up after the game the other night. I want to play you what he said.
I think us three being me, Brown, and Russ, we played 15, 21 games together. We didn't expect us to only have 21 games together, but just kind of been that year, you know, I'm in or he's in. And the times we do play together, we look really good. And then, you know, somebody's out of the lineup. So just kind of been that year. It's been tough not being able to fully reach our, potential as far as us three being on the floor and, you know, seeing what we really could be.
So, Howard, I heard that and I really wasn't buying it. I spent last weekend in Los Angeles. I watched the Lakers at close to full strength playing against the Pelicans. They lost that game despite a great game from LeBron. LeBron missed the game on Sunday against the Nuggets. The Lakers lost that game too. And they lose in like the exact same way every time. Poor fourth quarter execution, bad defense down the stretch, not a lot of continuity on either end of the floor. When I hear stuff like that, it just sounds like an excuse. I don't think that the Lakers season would be markedly different if they had been fully healthy all year long. Yes, they'd be in the playoffs. Like if Anthony Davis doesn't miss as much time as he does, they would be in the playoff mix. But would they be a contender? I'm not seeing it. I don't think health is the biggest reason the Lakers are in the predicament that they're in.
No. Look, let's be really clear here, Chris. And by the way, we can say this is the last time we're talking about the Lakers. You know damn well we're going to be talking about them again next week, the week after, the weekend. It'll be in the middle of the finals. The Lakers will still be making news somehow. Magic Johnson will make the rounds again, as he just did. We'll probably talk about that. Like, there'll be something. It's the Lakers. We're never free of them. And because we talk about the NBA for a living, you and I, like, this is the, you know, we're all wired this way. The second there's Laker news, we're going to be all over it again. So, you know, let's not pretend we're not going to be talking about them for the next 2 months. We will. Anthony Davis and Kevin Durant, all due respect to both men, great players, Kevin Durant in particular. And I understand where they're coming from, especially when you're talking about yourself, right? If you're Kevin Durant, of course, your first thought is, hey, man, if I don't miss those 6 weeks, it's a different season. And if you're Anthony Davis, though you're not at Kevin Durant's level, you're a really talented player who's won a championship and been on a bunch of all-star teams. And Anthony Davis, of course, is going to think, hey, if I had played more than, I think it's 39 games as we record this, then it would have been different. But that's not reality. This is not reality. All we have to do is like turn our attention for a minute to, let's say, the MVP race, right? Again, a subject we will come back to later in this podcast. The Denver Nuggets are 47-32 and about, I don't know, 5,000 games ahead of the Lakers in the standings. And they've been without their second and third best players all season. The Lakers have had time missed by LeBron. They've had a lot of time missed by Anthony Davis. But they're a team that was built around three stars. That was the point of the Russell Westbrook trade. Nothing, no conversation about the Lakers' failures gets more than a half a degree separation from the Russell Westbrook trade. Because the whole point of the exercise was not just to have a super team with these three stars that nobody in the league thought would mesh well, aside from the Lakers. But also because if LeBron misses time, as he does more and more often this late in his career, you've got somebody else who could do something with the ball in his hands at a high level. The whole point of the exercise, not the entire point of the exercise, a big part of the point of the exercise was that you get Russell Westbrook so you have another elite ball handler and playmaker. Russell Westbrook has played 77 games as you and I record this. 77 out of a possible 78. Russell Westbrook has missed one game. So if he's still the player that you thought you were acquiring, if Russell Westbrook can have the impact on winning that he's supposed to have, then, all right, sure, you're still going to lose some games because of Anthony Davis's injury or LeBron James's injury. But you got Russell Westbrook for this reason. Part of why you want multiple stars is that if some guys miss some time, you've got something to fall back on. And then when they're all three out there together, presumably you're overpowering. None of these things have happened. None of these things have come to pass because it was a bad idea from the beginning. We've talked about it 17 times on this podcast since the trade happened. And we probably will for the foreseeable future because it has put the Lakers not just in a momentary disadvantage for this season, in which they are not even going to make the play-in, which is still astounding, by the way. Even as much as people across the league, by the way, were skeptical of this trade, and you and I were skeptical of this trade, nobody thought it would be this catastrophic of an ending for the Lakers. So we're going to be talking about it for a while. But no, they're not in this position because of injuries. That contributed. It is not the most important factor.
No, it's not. I'm looking at the numbers of Davis, LeBron, and Westbrook. They played 21 games together this season. And if they had been lights out during those 21 games, I might be able to get next to that argument that Davis made. But in the 21 games together, the Lakers are 11-10. They have played 393 minutes together. They have averaged 18.7 minutes per game together. But they have a negative net rating in their games played of minus 3.6. That's not good. Like that, if you want to stretch that out over 75, 80 games, you're not going to convince me that, you know, more time together would make you a contender. You're a 500 team with that group. I mean, Anthony Davis is bringing up Kendrick Nunn. I get it. Kendrick Nunn would have been a valuable contributor to that second unit, maybe even the starting lineup. But come on, like it's Kendrick Nunn. All right, he's a good player, but I don't know that he's going to make a monstrous amount of difference on that team. So I don't buy that argument. The Lakers were poorly constructed from the beginning. Now, Magic Johnson, who inexplicably still has a voice in the Lakers organization, went on ESPN this week and had this to say about the construction of the Lakers roster.
When I think about it, the blame that he's got to take is the fact that DeRozan ended up in Chicago and not with the Lakers. You know, he has
expand to, on that thought if you
well,
would.
Why because is that on DeRozan LeBron? Wanted to play for the Lakers, and when I got the call from his agent, I called the Lakers, said, "Hey, he wants to come home." And DeRozan could have been a Laker instead of a Bull. We could have made that deal. But when Russell and LeBron and them started talking, that's when they nixed that deal and went with Westbrook, and he became a Laker instead of DeRozan. And I think with DeRozan, and then you had a chance to keep the role players, Caruso, KCP, all those guys who are our best defenders, mm-hmm. See, they left. And that's why we were a bad defensive team. But if you sign DeRozan, you only trade Kuzma for Buddy Hield, we would be playing in the Western Conference Championship this year with those two guys.
All right, so Howard, how Magic put it, it's really not that simple. Like, DeMar DeRozan was not going to sign with the Lakers for, like, the Kendrick Nunn exception or $5 million. DeMar DeRozan got, like, what, $25, $26 million per year from the Chicago Bulls. The Lakers were going to have to give him something in that neighborhood. I completely buy that DeRozan wanted to be a Laker, all things being equal. He's from Compton, went to school at USC. I think there's a connection there. He wants to be in Los Angeles with the Lakers. But it's not that simple to make a deal like that happen. Would he be better than Westbrook? Absolutely. I don't think a trio of DeMar DeRozan, LeBron James, Anthony Davis, which is what it probably would have had to have been, because the Spurs, who would have had to have been involved in a sign and trade for that deal to get done, we're not just going to give DeMar DeRozan to L.A. Like, Greg Popovich isn't voluntarily making the Lakers better. I mean, he's fine dealing DeRozan to Chicago and or being involved in something like that, but you're not going to do a deal with the Lakers to make them better without taking your pound of flesh them. So you probably would have insisted on Kuzma and the first round pick and whatever it, you know, whatever the Lakers gave up to get Russell Westbrook. So yeah, I you know, Magic kind of pulling back the curtain a little bit is interesting, but I don't know that that changes things all that dramatically either.
Probably not. I do think DeRozan would have been a better complementary player to LeBron and Anthony Davis than Russell Westbrook, but so would have been Buddy Hield, whose trade to the Lakers was so close that, as I think I've previously mentioned, somebody told me Hield already had his number, his jersey picked out at the time that that trade was suddenly undone so that they could trade for Russell Westbrook instead. Just a quick reminder, though. Yeah, so DeRozan goes Spurs to Bulls in a sign-and-trade deal. The Bulls send back Al-Farouq Aminu, Thaddeus Young, a 2025 first-round pick, a 2025 second-round pick, and there was some other swap or something in there. So the Lakers would have had to give up some stuff to get him. It wouldn't have been an outright signing. And, you know, yes, some of the stuff that went for Westbrook could have gone to San Antonio instead. I don't know what the construction of that deal looks like if they decide to do it. The bottom line is
probably, Howard, just to interject for a second, I mean, it would have been the first round pick that they gave up in the Westbrook deal.
Sure.
It probably would have been Kyle Kuzma. Maybe you could hold on to KCP and Montrezl Harrell. Maybe. Yeah. But you are dealing something significant to get him.
I think, listen, there's two things here. One, the Westbrook trade, you know, all right, there's so many things that obviously were problems with it. One, his contract alone. Two, his, you know, decreasing impact on the game, his just decreasing value to impact winning, and the awkward fit with LeBron in the first place. So there's all these things, but it was also how many pieces you had to give up to make that trade, partially for basketball purposes and partially for payroll purposes. And so you had to give up way more stuff to get Westbrook than you would have in either a Hield deal or a DeRozan deal. So aside from the fact that these players would have been a better fit, you also would not have hamstrung yourself as much because you would have kept back a player or two, a pick or two, and you could have used those in subsequent deals if you needed to. So it's everything. Everything about that Westbrook deal was a disaster. Real quick on the Magic thing, just peeling back the curtain, like, I mean, thanks, Magic, I guess. Like, it's great for us in the media. It's great that Magic is letting us in a little bit. I will always be all in favor of team executives, friends of team executives, former team executives in Magic's case, confidant, whatever his role is now, global ambassador, whatever his role is. You want to tell us everything that's going on, Magic? That's great. I'm not sure it's great for the Lakers or for LeBron or for GD Buss or for Rob Pelinka, but that's not my problem. So, you know, Magic, feel free to keep giving us great material and information about what's actually happened and why. But this is not helping the Lakers cause any in trying to dig themselves out from this mess or reestablish their credibility.
Do you find it at all mystifying that he's still involved in basketball operations in some way, shape, or form? I mean, Jeannie Buss has come out and said that she still talks to him and treats him like a confidant. Obviously a long history between Magic and the Buss family, Magic and Jeannie Buss, but it is wild to me that he has any influence whatsoever over the Laker organization. Now, Magic was not responsible for the Westbrook deal. Magic was not responsible for not giving up Talen Horton-Tucker, a deal that would have brought Kyle Lowry back at the trade deadline a year plus ago, which I think the Lakers would be in a better position for right now. But, and Lakers fans hate to hear me say this, but Magic overpaid for Anthony Davis. He did. I know they won a championship, and that's great. You can't take that away. Banner number 17 is up in the rafters at Fake Staples, crypto.com, whatever you want to call it right now, because of Anthony Davis. He was brilliant in the bubble. So I get it. But Howard, that team had the Pelicans over a barrel. Like, Anthony Davis had made it completely clear he didn't want to go anywhere but Los Angeles. I don't think the Lakers need to give up all that they gave up to get Davis. And because of that, it left them a little short on capital to make other deals, more flexibility to do other things down the line. That, to me, was a sign of an inexperienced executive. Yeah, you got your man, but you gave up everything to go and get him. And I think that, you know, is part of the reason the Lakers are in this predicament right now. I can't believe he still has a voice in all this. I can't believe that organization. Like, it's Magic. It's Rob Pelinka, who should be the final say, Rob Pelinka. It's Kurt and Linda Rambis for some reason. It's Jeannie Buss at the top. Like, there's so many voices and cooks in the kitchen that I don't know who's got the most influence at this point.
I wrote at the time that the Anthony Davis trade was made, and I'll say it again now, the Lakers won the trade and lost the negotiation. It was both things. If you get the best player, fine, you won the trade. You won a championship too, so you can now, you could say that everything is justified. Everything's vindicated. But it's not really the case. You overpaid for him at a time that, as you just said, they had all the leverage in the world. The Pelicans should have had no leverage whatsoever. Anthony Davis was a walkaway free agent who wanted one team and one team only. So that should have meant that the Pelicans had no leverage and the Lakers should have had all the leverage. And instead they gave up absolutely everything. Picks up the wazoo, multiple good players, including Brandon Ingram, who becomes an all-star, and Lonzo Ball, and Josh Hart, who is, you know, was really good for the Pelicans, has now been really, really good for the Blazers. And if you had held back at least a piece or two, if you had won the negotiation instead of losing the negotiation, yes, you'd be in better shape now, or you would have used those pieces to make the improvements you needed along the way over the last, over the last 5 months or so. But they didn't. They hamstrung themselves. And if you want to say they got the championship, so all things are justified, fine. It's no small thing getting a banner. But that's on Magic. That's on Pelinka, too. Everything else that's gone on the last year is on Pelinka. I mean, if LeBron's pushing for Russ and you don't think it's a good idea as the chief basketball executive, you say no. If you think Buddy Hield's the better piece and you've already negotiated the trade for Buddy Hield to this point where Buddy Hield's picking out his number, and you believe that that's your best move, Rob Pelinka, then you stick to your guns and you make the trade for Buddy Hield. You make the trade for Kyle Lowry when you had the chance. You don't overestimate the value of a Talen Horton-Tucker, who's now worth, you know, a quarter of what he might have been worth at the time of a potential Lowry deal a year ago. You don't let Caruso walk for nothing. And if the owner says, we don't want to pay the luxury tax or it's too much, you push back as hard as you possibly can. Jeannie hired you for a reason. you know, you make it clear this is our best way forward. We can't let Alex Caruso walk for nothing. He's too valuable. I mean, it's just one mistake after another, and you know, look, you would put in the notes for this podcast today, hey, what, you know, what's next? How do they fix it, all this? My first thought is not about how to fix the roster. It's fixing the front office first. And I'm not advocating for anybody to lose their job. I, you know, this may sound like that. I don't do that. What I am saying is you need some real serious creativity in that front office. And it doesn't have to be like replacing everybody. Maybe it's just augmenting. Just hire somebody who's been, who's done this kind of work before. Rob Pelinka hadn't until he got this job, and now he's been in the chair for a couple of years, but I don't think we've seen anything from this front office to suggest that they have the creativity and the wherewithal to make the kinds of moves that they need to make to get themselves out of this hole. And it's really tough because they don't have that many assets, as we've talked about. Sure, they'll have another pick and play once we get past this upcoming draft, but you don't want to have to trade a ton of future picks. You don't have anything on your roster that anybody else wants. You're going to need some serious creativity. And I think that means bringing in somebody else from the outside to give you the kind of creative juice that you just have not shown in the last 3 years.
Well, you used the word creativity a few times there. I think that's going to be the key, because you've got to find a way to get out of the Russell Westbrook business, basically. When I was in L.A., you know, talking to people within the organization about Westbrook, their experience with him, they see kind of an Iverson-like arc to him. Because one of the things I was exploring was, you know, kind of, are there any signs that Westbrook could eventually make that Jason Kidd-like turn to a different level, where he becomes a perimeter shooter after spending years having that as a weakness in his game? And I was told by multiple people that just doesn't seem like it's in the cards. Like, he's just, his shooting numbers are not only not getting better, they're getting worse. And from what I'm told behind the scenes, it's not like that's a priority to him, that becoming a better shooter is just not one of his points of emphasis at this point. There's still a big part of Russell Westbrook that believes he can still be Russell Westbrook, the guy we saw win MVP 6 years ago. And that's just not there anymore. He doesn't shoot it well. He doesn't defend at all. And the Lakers are kind of stuck with him. To offload him, you're either going to have to throw in a draft pick, maybe two, or be willing to take worse contracts back, or at least contracts that extend a season or two more beyond Westbrook's deal. And if you're going to do that, you better get the right kind of players. Like, you need athletes, you need length, you need switchability on defense, all things the Lakers have lacked all season long. You can't win with their version of Powerball, with this aging roster filled with the Dwight Howards and Carmelo Anthony's, and before that, DeAndre Jordan. So you just can't win that way. So how the Lakers handle the Westbrook situation this offseason is really going to be critical. They've got to find a way to turn him into a positive, even if it's just a slight positive. They've got to turn him into a positive in order to give themselves any chance at competing for anything next year.
Yeah, agreed. And the real issue, Chris, is obviously there's no market for Westbrook, especially at $47 million. Even on an expiring, you've got to find a team. You know, whether it's this John Wall, you know, swap that we've been talking about for literally months.
You know, by the way, I'll let you finish. But yeah, like, at some point, can we have, in a future podcast? I know people in Houston hate when I talk about the Rockets because they're like, I always get that you don't watch any of their games. You don't,
is there a market that doesn't hate you talking about their team, Chris?
I don't actually, no. Boston usually does too, but you know, whatever.
How are you with Vancouver? Are old Vancouver Grizzlies fans like okay? Like, is there enough time for them to have recovered?
I think, yeah, they're good with me. I had a limited amount of time talking about them. But I don't really we'll get back to this down the road, but like that John Wall spent an entire season on the shelf is still wild to me. Like it's still it's incredible to me. But go ahead, continue on the Lakers.
Well, no, so all right, so look, there's that scenario, right? In which probably the Lakers are still having to incentivize the Rockets to make the deal. The Lakers are still the more desperate of the two parties here. So they're the ones who have to put in something else. All right. If it's not Houston, then who? Well, there's this Knicks scenario that we throw around because the Knicks are kind of desperate and they could package Randall and other multiple, you know, other random pieces to make up the $47 million or something. And now the Lakers get a bunch of smaller priced parts that might fit around LeBron better. The Knicks get a one-year flyer on Westbrook and juice up the Garden a little bit until they figure out what the heck it is they're doing. I don't know, but like none of these sound that attractive. And like how many other teams... And listen, I hate to talk about it this way. Westbrook's a future Hall of Famer, but he's at $47 million, worst season of his career, trending downward, probably not going to be the old Westbrook again wherever he lands. So how many teams want to pay him $47 million even for one season and are in a kind of situation where it makes sense for them to do it just to get his number off the books at the end of it, right? I don't know who else that is, Chris.
Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City would take him if you give them a draft pick. They'll sell some tickets off him, try to revive him for 1 year, and if you give them a first round pick, Sam Presti would probably take him.
All right, listen. There's obviously some like sentimental notes that you can sound there that are kind of fun. Westbrook going back there, obviously a place that worships the ground he walks on, all that. But even that scenario, Chris, they've got a young team with some really talented young players who happen to be ball handlers, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, correct, Josh Giddey. And they're building something interesting. I don't know where it's going, but they've got good young talent. As we know, 8 bazillion picks and cap room. What are they doing like messing with this? Like Westbrook comes in at like, all right, so does he sets a tone for guys or he teaches them how to be like, what? I don't know, maybe, but I that's going backwards, it feels like, for them. So I don't even buy into that one, sentiment aside, and I'm the most sentimental person I know, but like I don't see it. So there just aren't that many dumping grounds for his contract right now. So the Lakers are in a almost impossible. I would love to sit here and do like find this big creative solution. Like I played with the trade machine for 3 hours, and here's this great perfect solution I came up with. I don't know that one exists.
Yeah, I don't either. It's going to take an incredible amount of creativity to get something of value for Westbrook that helps you win a title in the last year of LeBron's contract, with hopefully a healthy Anthony Davis next year. And by the way, a completely overhauled roster, since half of it is going to be a free agent and you have to replace or re-sign a whole bunch of guys within that group. So the challenge is on that Lakers front office beginning probably in about a week or so. All right, I want to touch briefly on the news that came out of Philadelphia this week. ESPN reported that Ben Simmons is headed to arbitration with the 76ers over the $20 million the Sixers have been withholding or are withholding from his contract. I had been curious, Howard, if Ben Simmons was getting his money. Like, it never was clear to me, like, if he was getting paid or not during his time out of the Philadelphia lineup. And when I spent some time with Joel Embiid last week in Los Angeles, that was the first time it seemed like he wasn't. Because Embiid, when I was talking to him about Simmons and him Simmons sitting out and how long he'd be out, Embiid had said, I figured he'd come back just for the money. Like, that's a lot of money to be leaving on the table. Turns out Embiid was right. Simmons has not been getting paid or was not getting paid after that first lump payment that he received in the last offseason. Simmons now going to arbitration to try to recoup that money. This, to me, Howard, is a pretty important case for the NBA because Ben Simmons has cited mental health as the reason that he was out of that Philadelphia lineup, which creates a slippery slope here because, look, we still don't know if the primary reason Ben Simmons was not playing for Philadelphia was a mental health issue, or if it was because, as he attempted all offseason, to get a trade out of Philadelphia, or a negotiating tactic, or a ploy to get out of Philadelphia. This is going to be, I think, a pivotal moment for the NBA, for this type of arbitration, to see which direction it goes, because I mean, you hate to think that mental health, you know, down the line could be used as a negotiating tactic, but you know, you can't rule it out in if a situation like this plays out in favor of Ben Simmons.
Yeah, this is a really interesting case. And I feel like the Simmons saga has become like further muddied by the fact that he hasn't played for the Nets either, and not as far as any of us know, for any reasons of mental health or mental readiness, as they put it earlier in the season with Philly, but solely because of his back issues, which are absolutely legitimate, which makes you wonder, if he couldn't play this whole time because of back issues, why wasn't that the reason he wasn't playing with Philly and not this other?
That was my first thought. Like, you know? If your back is that bad, look, his back issues, I believe it's like 3 years now. If you go back to 2020, at the end of the season before it was cut short because of the pandemic, if that season had ended there, or if that season had continued rather, he wouldn't be able to play. His back was that bad. The only reason he finished the season with the Sixers is because they had 3 months off and he was able to get back into the kind of condition necessary. Like, a back injury for Ben Simmons is perfectly legitimate.
Yes. And if you have a legitimate injury that is keeping you from getting on the court with your teammates in Philadelphia, then your camp is never going to play this other card. And again, I'm not saying that that means that that card wasn't legitimate, the mental health card. I'm saying that you know what's going to come along with that in terms of people doubting it or suspecting that this is just a ploy.
It's fair, Howard, it's fair to say.
And I'm not saying it's...
Yeah, listen, fair to say, though, the 76ers don't believe it's legitimate. If they believed it was legitimate, they wouldn't have withheld that money.
Right. But because that is a more difficult one to prove and invites more cynicism, frankly, from not just the club, but from the public, from fans, if it's physical, it's easier to document, right? If it's physical, there's no gray area. It's hard to document mental health and say that that's the reason I can't practice or play for your team. But physical, my L4 disc, I think it is, my L4 disc is jacked up. So that's the easier path for you, both politically and with regard to not getting pay withheld, right? It's an injury. You can document it. It's physical. It's tangible. It's documentable. It's imageable, if I could create a verb. Like, so they could have stuck with that, which leads me to think that the back, while always a lingering issue for him for the last couple of years, as you pointed out, was not so messed up that it kept him off the court in the fall, but somewhere along the way during his private workouts or during an early workout with the Nets, something else happened. That's the logical explanation in my mind, right? I don't know that, but that to me makes more sense than anything else. Because if the back were that messed up the whole time, including in Philly at the beginning of the season, you would have just used that as your reason for not being on the court. You wouldn't have needed any other reason, especially one as delicate as mental health. So, all right. So they've docked him all this pay. He's trying to get it back. You and I don't know, as we sit here, whether or not there's a legitimate case for him to get it back or what that will rest on. I think the only thing I could say about it is it's fascinating. I'm interested to see where that goes. I do wonder what kind of precedent it could set for others, whether with legitimate or illegitimate claims of mental health concerns, if somebody wants out of a situation or doesn't want to play for whatever reason.
And Howard, I don't mean to be glib with this, but like, if an arbiter rules in favor of Ben Simmons, like, I want to say this correctly, because I don't want to, you know, if you have a legitimate mental health issue, and Ben Simmons could have a legitimate mental health issue, especially when it comes to Philadelphia, but like, if does it not create a potential opportunity for a player who's having just a rough go of it in City X to say, look, I'm mentally not able to play here anymore. I'm mentally not able to be part of this organization, be part of this city, be around this team anymore. Does it not create that type of precedent for a player to do something like that?
Maybe, right? Maybe. I don't know.
I don't either. That's the point. Like, I don't yeah, either.
And that's the thing, right? Like, the NBA in particular, Adam Silver, as commissioner, has spoken very passionately and I think earnestly about the concerns for the mental health of players in this league. And we have seen over the last however many years it's been now, 5-6 years with Kevin Love, your guest later in this show, and DeMar DeRozan boldly, you know, discussing their own issues in the public space and really opening the doors for more people to discuss this openly in a way where you can lessen the stigma, because there shouldn't be a stigma. So we've had all this positive progress in discussing mental health among NBA players and among pro athletes. And with this case, with the Ben Simmons case, because there's an ambiguity here, Ben Simmons has never actually discussed it, right? Like, we don't actually know. So, like, I've said this before and I'll say it again. Wherever people stand on this, people who absolutely don't believe him at all, people who say we should believe him at face value and exercise no skepticism whatsoever, wherever you are on that spectrum or somewhere in between, I think we could all agree on this much. Ben Simmons has not discussed this in any public way that would help us understand what the issue is. And he's not obligated to if he has some issue. But I'm just saying, in the case of a DeMar DeRozan or a Kevin Love, Kevin Love has explained the panic attack he had in the middle of a game one day. And that's helped us understand what that means and why it happened and what he's done about it and how he thinks about it. We know nothing about Ben Simmons, not in this context or almost in any context. He's been in the league for like 5 years and we know almost nothing. He's just a complete mystery box. And again, that doesn't mean people should not doubt. I'm not telling anybody how they should feel about it. I'm just saying that it's harder for us to get our head around and understand it properly and discuss it in the right context, because we've only had his camp whispering to select outlets about these mental health concerns or mental readiness or whatever it is.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if Ben Simmons at some point does a longer sit down, or as Kevin Love did, write about his issues. Kevin did it, I believe, what, the Players Tribune? I
believe so, yeah.
Initially, and has spoken about it at length at other outlets, become a real outstanding advocate and voice for the visibility of mental health issues. I'd be interested if Ben Simmons takes any kind of similar approach. Keeping it with the Nets, but going back to the court here, the Nets, they're pretty much locked in for the play-in tournament. Depending on where they finish in the seedings, it's still unclear. You know, last week we saw kind of the best and the worst of the Nets. We saw them lose in a very close game to the Milwaukee Bucks that made you think, maybe I don't really want to see that team in the first round of the playoffs. They're probably easier teams for me to face. Before that, you saw them play and give up 123 points in a win over Detroit. You saw them give 119 points in a loss against Charlotte. Howard, you have been pretty consistent on not really fearing the Nets in the playoffs. Where do you stand on that right now? And by the way, it looks like Simmons, at least according to Steve Nash, not going to play the rest of the regular season, not going to play in the play-in tournament, and we'll see where it stands. So this version of the Nets, without Ben Simmons, without Joe Harris, maybe even without Seth Curry the rest of the way, he's got an ankle issue that seems to be more problematic than the Nets are comfortable with. You know, are the Nets a team to be avoided during the final week of the regular season as teams start to kind of jockey at the top for positioning?
Chris, you're suggesting that teams, as the playoffs approach, might actually try to win some games and lose others just to manipulate where they are in the standings and choose their own first round matchup? That wouldn't happen, would it?
How dare I?
I mean, to the extent this happens, and like, it's not completely in your hands too, right? Like, you can try to manipulate this. I'm a believer in the basketball gods and karma in this case, where it's like, you mess around, you're going to have it bite you in the ass. Like, I don't think that's a good idea, but it's harder. I don't know if it's easier or harder because of this. The standings are so tight at the top of the East, whereas you and I talk right now, there is 2.5 games separating first place Miami from the fourth place 76ers, and the Sixers and Bucks are tied at 48 and 30, 2.5 games out. Those teams are so close that trying to manipulate your way in and out of a certain position isn't that easy, because the next night it could swing back again. And, you know, we don't know where the Nets are going to land in all this either. Right now it's looking more likely than not that the Nets are going to be in the bottom part of the play-in, which means they've got to win twice just to get to eighth. So they're probably not seventh, right? Like, to be seventh in the seedings, you have to be either the seventh or eighth best team in the regular season and then win that first play-in game, right? So the Nets are not going to be seventh. They're almost certainly going to be eighth if they make the playoffs. So now you're trying to avoid being number one? I don't think anybody's going to try to avoid being number one and having home court advantage throughout the East, are they?
I'm blanking on how the rules work. The Nets can't be seven no matter what?
So, I'm pretty sure I have this right. Seventh and eighth play and ninth and tenth play, right? So, seven and eight play for the right to be seventh. And if you win...
You're right. Yeah.
So right now that's Cleveland at seven and Hawks at eighth.
I believe though the Nets can still theoretically get to eight, so they could play for the right to be seven.
Right. They're a game out of eighth place right now. Right. As it stands right now, so if they got to eighth and then beat the seventh team, which would be Cleveland right now, then yes, the Nets could get to seventh. Right now they're in the 9-10 matchup against Charlotte. So that you win that, and then you got to beat the loser of the 7-8. And then that's to be eighth. All of which is just to say that there's like a lot of variables still in play here before we even get to the play-in. And so it's too much for the Celtics or the Heat or the Bucks or anybody to I think even think about in terms of standings manipulation. To the real underpinning of your question though, Chris, which is should people fear the Nets? I mean, I guess yes, because Durant and Kyrie together can be scary. But if the Lakers have taught us anything this season, actually, for that matter, if the Nets have taught us anything this season, it's that the role players really matter. And in the playoffs, they might matter even more because the defenses are going to be squarely focused on, you know, messing things up for Durant and Kyrie, taking the ball out of their hands and make their teammates beat you. And if their teammates aren't in rhythm or are banged up or just aren't very good, then that works in your favor. And we also saw, by the way, you mentioned that Nets-Bucks game. Kyrie did nothing down the stretch of that game because Drew Holiday locked him up at times, because Kyrie himself locked himself up by dribbling down the shot clock for 22 seconds before shooting. There's nothing from the Nets, aside from the names on those jerseys of you know, Durant and Irving, and what those guys are capable of individually, Durant in particular, I'm not sure I'm fearing them as a team. I've got respect for what Durant and Kyrie can do, but I'm not fearing the Nets as a team. They lack cohesion. They lack consistency. They don't play defense consistently. And if Ben Simmons suddenly is cleared on the eve of the play-in, actually Nash has basically said he's not playing in the play-in either. If they make it out of the play-in and now he's cleared for game one of the playoffs, a guy who hasn't played in almost a year and has never played for the Nets? I mean, come on. Like, the Nets, if I had to predict right now, the Nets are not getting out of the first round.
Look, I wouldn't want to play them. I also wouldn't be all that enthusiastic about playing Atlanta right now. They're playing some good basketball. So, like, at this point, as we record this on April 5th, I wouldn't get too cute in the standings. But if I'm sitting up there, last game of the regular season, and a loss would drop me from 2-3. Probably losing that game. I'm probably going out of my way to lose that game because I would probably take my chances with some combination of Chicago, Toronto, Cleveland, frankly.
I'm not sure I want to play Toronto.
What's that?
I mean, I understand, like, the Raptors don't have a Kevin Durant. The Raptors don't have a Trae Young even. But the Raptors are really, really good, and they're long, and they're defensively feisty, and they just got a butt. Like, I want to roll.
I know. I probably want Cleveland because they're young. Yeah. Chicago.
Yeah.
Their defense has not been the same. Although Patrick Williams is back. I mean, look, there's no game. The answer to my own question, I wouldn't want to play the Nets. I just wouldn't. I wouldn't want to go up against Kevin Durant in a series. I wouldn't want to go up against Kyrie Irving in a playoff series. Those two guys have proven to be great in the postseason before.
Yes.
And those are the type of guys I would want to avoid, if possible, down that line. But you bring up Toronto. This is what I want to touch on next.
Yeah.
Toronto, because of Canadian rules, if you play the Raptors in the playoffs, you must have a fully vaccinated team. And Tim Bontemps, our friend over at ESPN, checked in with the teams at the top of the Eastern Conference playoff bracket and asked them if their teams were fully vaccinated. Milwaukee, they said yes. Miami, they said yes. Philadelphia and Boston did not confirm. Didn't say one way or the other, but did not confirm that. This to me is a story, Howard, whether I know people are sick of talking about vaccination status and yada, yada, yada. This is about eligibility. And I'm in Boston, and this has been kind of a dance that the media has done around the Celtics for the last few days now, where the three guys that didn't play in Toronto last week, talking specifically about Al Horford, Jaylen Brown, and Jason Tatum, there's not clarity on their vaccination status. Now, Tatum has said in the preseason that he was vaccinated. Horford and Brown, it's like this word salad that keeps getting played with these guys, where it's like Al Horford says he will be ready to play anywhere. Jaylen Brown says something similar, but neither one of them is coming out and saying straight out that they are vaccinated, which would seemingly be the easiest way to put this issue to bed once and for all. Brad Stevens was on the radio last week saying, I'm not going to comment on the vaccination status of my players. Now, we are approaching a important date because to be eligible to play in Canada, you simply can't get vaccinated the day of the game. You've got to get vaccinated and have, if you take the Johnson & Johnson shot, the one shot, and then have 2 weeks in between. That means you're fully vaccinated in Canada. That's at some point this week if you're assuming that games 3 and 4 are played in Toronto. So, you know, I don't know how it's all going to shake out, but I'm still very curious to see what happens if Philadelphia or Boston winds up in a first-round series with Toronto, and if everybody's eligible to play in a series like that, because that could make a difference against a team that, as you point out, is as good, is as experienced in the playoffs, and as well-coached as Toronto.
So, within the last couple of weeks, somebody argued on Kyrie's behalf on this level of simply asking me, you and others have been critical of Kyrie, and there's been so much focus on Kyrie. How come he's the only one? He's not the only unvaccinated player. To which my response was, yeah, but he's the only really important player on a team with the highest aspirations that has actually denied his services to his team all season. And I said that will change if somebody else who's significant, not some, you know, 14th man or whatever, but somebody else who is really important to their team can't play for any reason because of their vaccination status. That hasn't been the case. All the focus has been on Kyrie, not because he's Kyrie, but because he's been public about it and because he couldn't play at all for a couple months because the Nets didn't want to do the home road thing. Then eventually they caved and let him play just the road games. So he's been the face of it because partially because he chose to be and partially because of circumstances because he plays in New York and New York had the strictest laws. So to this whole issue now, we are now getting very close to the point, or we may be getting close to the point where it won't be just be about Kyrie. It may be other players who are costing their teams a chance at a deep playoff run. And it might be the Celtics. Gary Washburn in the Boston Globe, I think this was today, maybe it was yesterday, says, quote, according to an NBA source, at least 2 frontline players are not vaccinated. Maybe that's Horford and Jaylen Brown.
I mean,
maybe it's 2 others.
If you just look at it, like it
has to be
Horford,
right?
Brown, or Tatum. And Tatum is the one that's come out and said, I got vaccinated. So
it is, yes. It seems very, very likely that it is Jaylen Brown and Al Horford. If they do not get vaccinated, let's be very careful here. If in fact they are not vaccinated, and if in fact they do not get vaccinated in time to play first round games in Toronto, one, we will know very soon.
Yes.
Because they won't be there.
Canada's not changing its laws in the next couple of weeks.
No,
it's not.
No, and not for the NBA. Canada is not as easy to roll as the Yankees rolled Mayor Eric Adams in New York. So we'll know. And to the question that was posed to me by this person arguing pseudo on Kyrie's behalf a couple weeks ago, all right, guess what? A lot of scrutiny and criticism is going to be coming the way of Celtics players if they can't play playoff games in Toronto that they need to win. The focus will change very quickly to other players, or they will be in the same, the same spotlight that Kyrie's been in this whole time. So we'll know. This it's interesting because we talk about where we all operate now as if the pandemic is over and it's behind us, but it's not over. COVID's not over. And as far as Canada's laws are concerned, it certainly isn't. And it may yet have an influence on this NBA postseason.
Yeah. Like you said, we'll find out very quickly, you know, who's eligible and who's not, because if that series, if any of these teams, and right now it just looks like Philadelphia and Boston wind up matched with Toronto, you know, this week's it. If you're going to get vaccinated, you got to do it this week. Otherwise, you're not going to fit that 14-day window to be vaccinated in time to enter the country. And then we'll find out then and there. Howard, next week, we are going to unveil our ballot, specifically our MVP ballot at the top. Real quick, I assume you're still undecided at this point. How tricky is this vote for you right now?
It's really tricky. You know what's really funny, Chris? Because there have been other votes that were close historically, right? But in my own head, right, there are a lot of years where there's a bunch of good candidates, but I usually have a really strong idea. I might wait till the last minute to file my ballot anyway. I always do. It's just kind of my habit. But I don't remember being this tortured about it ever, right? Like the year Westbrook won it over Harden and Kawhi was considered a really competitive race on some level, but Westbrook won it by a lot. And there was no doubt in my mind that it was not Westbrook, that it was Harden. I did not have a hard time making that choice that year. I did not have a hard time making a choice the 2 years Giannis won it, and I voted for him both times, or the 2 years that Steph Curry won it, and I voted for him both times. This one's really tough because this is all about what we come down to the definitions, right? People who are defining MVP based on who had the best season are looking at Jokic and saying it's obvious, right? Look at his stats, look at his advanced stats, look at more advanced stats, look at even deeper advanced stats. And yes, there's all those indicators point to Jokic, but the Nuggets are not a contender. And I know the Nuggets and Sixers with Embiid and Bucks with Giannis, those are your three top candidates. I understand these teams are all within a game of each other in the standings. It just so happens that it takes more wins to get higher in the West standings than in the East. So the Nuggets look worse by standing than the Sixers and Bucks do. I get that. But the history of this award for the last almost 40 years is that the MVP comes from a plausible contender. I won't even say straight up contender. I won't even say top contender. A plausible contender. Westbrook being the lone exception in the last nearly 40 years. The Nuggets are not a contender. And whatever doubts we may have about the Sixers, there's still a scenario where the Sixers can make the finals. The Bucks are the defending champs and absolutely can make the finals and win another championship. If I'm going to go by my own framework that I've stood by for years, which is that I believe the MVP comes from a top team, not from a good team, not from a so-so team, not from a sub-50 win team, frankly, because that's been the standard, then it gets a lot harder with Jokic. And Jokic, by the way, if they win out, the Nuggets get to 50 wins. They'll hit the magic number. And again, if people want to look it up, every MVP aside from Westbrook for the last 30-something years, 35, 37 years, something like that, has come from a team that won at least 50 or in a shortened season, the equivalent of that. So if it was a lockout shortened season, if it was a pandemic shortened season, the winning percentage still measures out to what would have been 50-plus in a normal season. So it's been the case. I believe in that precedent. I'm having a really tough time. It's one of those three guys, Chris, and the other two will be in my second and third slots in some order. And here we are, we have less than a week to go. Ballots due next Monday, by the end of the day. I'm tortured on this one. How about you?
Yeah, I believe, in my notes, I have, I believe 48 of the last 50 MVPs have been top three teams in the standings. So they have been contenders. With Westbrook, and I forget who it was, somebody earlier on that was not inside the top three. So, I'm tortured, and we'll definitely dive into our rationale after the votes are submitted next week on next Tuesday's pod. Howard, good stuff. And when we come back, Kevin Love. All right, Kevin Love is here, Cavaliers forward, 5-time NBA All-Star. He is here on behalf of Milkbone. You can also find Kevin on posters in the Los Angeles area. And Kevin joins me on the show. Kevin, can you walk me through what exactly was going through your mind when LeBron comes down the lane like that? Like, what, at what point do you realize that ends badly?
You know, I kind of had a feeling that when I saw him coming down the lane and the speed and the form, just the whole slow motion breakdown of the whole situation just was not going to end well. And it's funny because, like, he barely hit me. And I gave him that, like, extra Tom Chambers type of lift. And his head was at the rim and could have stuck his armpit in the rim. Like, and the way that I felt, like, trying to sell the charge. And then once it happened, I just kind of, like, flailed my arms and, you know, almost, like, rolled over backwards. I was like, okay, this is going to be bad. So at halftime, he's like, what were you doing jumping in front of that? Like, what the hell were you doing? So I, you know, joked around, put him in a headlock. But after the game, you know, spoke to him and Russ. We had a good laugh about it. But he's so smart because I had told him, you know, we have our 2016 group chat. And I'm like, you know, I've been putting my body on the line. He's like, yeah, man, you've been hell of a job taking charges, blah, blah, blah. But I was like, man, I'm right at the lead of you know, leading the league in that hustle stat of charges taken. And I think off the bench, I'm close to number one for that. So I think he's so smart. He had that in his mind because both times I think he had the and one on the charge where I think I was still moving. And then he had the crazy dunk where I tried to take, you know, another charge. So Bron is like so cerebral, so smart, like sponge, and just like, you know, stepping in front of that. He was right. I had no business doing that.
Off the top, I just want to say that's a tremendous Tom Chambers reference.
I mean, I watched that, the superstar videos I watched when I was young. I were around that a number of times. It was amazing.
Also the greatest video game dunker ever, Chambers.
Oh, ever. Like,
dunks from, I mean, the 3-point.
He was like a 100-point score on that, like attributes, like dunking, 100. Amazing.
We were talking just before we started recording about kind of the injury bug you guys are dealing with right now, but this has been a phenomenal season for the Cavaliers, really from the start. For you personally, what's been the most enjoyable part of this season?
Honestly, it's something as simple as just being around this group, from front office, coaching staff, and all the guys that we have, like watching DG come into his own after losing Colin, taking that next step in his growth and leadership and just overall game. Evan being the rookie of the year, playing at a high level, stepping in, playing significant minutes and being productive the entire year. JA just being so solid for us. You know, Isaac Okoro, the last 2.5-3 months has been quietly great for us. You know, seeing our three, you know, going against the grain, playing 3 7-footers, having success with that. Like, outside of our injuries, you know, we've been really successful, and we've seen, you know, a top 5 defense out of us for most of the season. You know, holding teams to a very, very low percentage in field goal percentage and in points allowed. Just all the way across the board, our bench guys stepping in. Like, you know, Ricky was so great for us. I know that we lost him. We lost Colin. We fought that injury bug. But still, you know, we were expected to win maybe, you know, in the mid to low, maybe high 20s, you know, this year. And last year we won 22 games. And as of last night, we're you know, over the 41 mark. And we hit 42. It's a winning season. It's plus 20. We still have, what, 6 or 7 games left. So I think, obviously thought we could have got a little bit more out of this season. In terms of the win column, we still have some work to go or some games to go. But, you know, those injuries definitely hit us hard, but still successful in our own right.
You know, when you signed that 4-year extension with Cleveland back in 2018, I thought two things at the time. One, good for you for getting paid and getting that locked in at this stage of your career. The other, honestly, was you're probably never going to win again. I mean, that was when LeBron left, and we saw what happened the last time LeBron left Cleveland. Like, at the time, did any of that cross your mind?
It definitely did, and I've actually had a conversation or conversations with Draymond about it. Like, you lose, you know, guys for a season or for so long, like he did with Clay and with Steph, guys that were so monumental and leave such a hole in what you're trying to accomplish. Like, you go from, you know, making the finals 4 years straight to then, you know, kind of being at the bottom of, you know, not only your conference and the NBA, like, there's no preparing yourself for that. I had an idea of kind of that's where we'd be headed and it would be a longer rebuild, but you know, you fast forward to now, I think most rebuilds, I was reading something somewhere where it's like 8+ years to get, you know, where we are today and where we want to go. And the fact that it's turned around so quickly, like the front office has done amazing job. Like we've gone against the grain at a number of different times in drafting another guard in DG to pat, you know, to put next to Colin, to play a three big starting lineup to get Lowry Markkanen, to draft Evan Mobley. And then, you know, on top of that, it's like, you know, we add Jared Allen in that big trade last year, which is so monumental for starting things off on the right foot for us as well. So definitely were, you know, made great decisions, was put in the right position. We have continuity with JB Bickerstaff. We have continuity with the front office. But just I think the culture that we have enforced, we just have grown and put in place, has made for, you know, really great things for us. So that really sped that up. And, you know, to your point, you know, yeah, I mean, I looked at it as something as, you know, man, this is going to take, you know, a long time. And, you know, there were some good moments. There are some pretty bad moments that I had both on and off the floor. But, you know, for me to be in a landing spot where I'm at now, it's the most fun I've had since the 15-16 season, just being around these guys and coming into work every single day.
Yeah, and you mentioned the 22 games last year. That's 30% of you, 30% winning percentage last year. You're probably going to double that this season with a winning percentage right now at about 55%. Yeah. Were there any signs last season towards the end that this group, granted with the addition of Evan Mobley, which is a game changer, but there were any signs last season that this group was capable of that, this type of turnaround?
I think there were some flashes, but again, like, you know, you add Evan, you add Lowry, guys get a whole summer of work underneath their belt. We understand what JB wants out there on the floor. You know, for myself, getting healthy, you know, getting into that six man role, adding Ricky, like we looked around and we thought we have a good team here. There's a good team here, a team that could really make some noise. And I think we were like the only ones that really believed that was possible. And we said it every single day. And I think that's where really that culture came from, and understanding that we were going to play big. And then coming off the bench, we were just going to play free, play open, and just being an absolute extension of you know, what that first unit had done for us. So we'd start games off great on both sides of the ball, and then we'd come in and just there'd be no drop off. So I think, you know, every day in practice, us going against that first unit and trying to beat them up, I think we all lifted each other up and understood, hey, we can win a lot of games and teams are going to have trouble with us.
So Evan Mobley comes to training camp. At what point do you realize, okay, this guy's really good?
Right away. I mean, it was funny because, like, I'm looking at him, I'm like, no, he's all of 7 feet. He has... You know, his offensive game is raw, and I'm like, is he going to be more of a face-up guy? But if you look at him, like, he'll face up, and then he'll go straight into – it surprised me, like, just started, like, you know, banging, putting his shoulder into guys. And I thought, man, when he really, you know, refines and grows his offensive game, his defense is already there. But when he really grows, like, into his body, being – he was 19 years old, now 20 – you know, gets a full year, maybe another year underneath his belt. Like, he's going to be a real problem in this league. And, you know, he's going to be a very, very special player. It's been amazing to see his growth as well within what we're doing.
He gets that Anthony Davis comparison a lot. Do you see that, or is there somebody else that you would compare him to?
Yeah, and I think, you know, for me, it's comparing, it's so hard because I say KG a lot too, because in how they move and how they are defensive minded, yet they both have that like elbow jumper. You know, they both get those tip dunks, they get like just that in itself, but in the way that they approach the game, it's a little different as well. Like KG is just one of one. There's like, they broke the mold with him, right? But I just think in his body type, the way that he moves, the way that he plays and he operates, there are some similarities there, just like there are with Anthony Davis. But I think Evan is the type of guy, he takes everything in stride, and he wants to be like the first Evan Mobley, right? Like that's what he wants. And we just want him to be himself because he's low maintenance. He doesn't need much. He just wants to go out there and play and get better. And that's why, you know, again, it's so fun coming into work every single day because he puts the time in, everybody puts the time in, and, you know, we just want to get better. And that's all you can ask for at his age.
he contests everything. It's wild watching him out there. Like,
yeah, him and Jay together, it's wild. They can their contest rate is very, very high. It's top of the league.
Yeah, it's insane. You have not been a reserve since your rookie season. Even then, you started almost half the games in Minnesota. This season, you're likely going to start single-digit games for the year. Was accepting that challenging?
You know, it actually wasn't. It's funny. I don't know if because it was I was in such a good mental headspace, and I trust JB. I trust our front office. You know, we've gone back and forth, but there's been so much more positive than negative, especially through this regrowth and rebuild of our team. So I think in just having that and understanding that, hey, like I'm going to earn my minutes, but JB's like 20 to 25 minutes a night. I was like, I still get a lot done then. And being a sixth man role could actually be very fun with this team. Very, very fun. And he's like, I want you to play free. You have the green light to do as, you know, as you do so well as the intent is there, which I know it will be. And so for me, there was no like pushback. I was basically like, yep, I'm all good. I looked at him. I'm like off the bench. Yep. Good. That was it. And from then on, it took me about, I'd say 4 to 6 weeks to really, feel right and secure and find, you know, how I was going to play within, you know, our group and different matchups and who I was going to be playing with. So like, I'd say around December 1st is where I found myself within that six man role. And then again, just grew from there.
It's, and you probably know this, but it feels like it's almost a way too, for you individually to add like 3 more years onto your career. I mean, 100%. Jamal Crawford just retired. He's 42 years old. Like, I mean, he would have been done years ago if he hadn't become a sixth man.
No, and I think that's definitely an outlook that I'm taking too. Like I feel great. I haven't really tried to think about it too much, but I think it's the most games I've played maybe since 15, 16. So I feel amazing. My body feels great. Mentally, I feel great. Again, it makes it easier when it's refreshing, coming into work and we have this culture that we have set in place, but no, definitely body, like you said, feels great. Put the work in, the second half of this summer to get right. And then, coming off the bench, like you said, I think it can add a lot of time to my career. I talk all the time about Kobe saying he played half his life in the NBA when he was like 34 or 35 after coming in at 17, 18. And that's something that I want to be able to say. And as you know, like in this league, if you can rebound and you can shoot, you can basically play for as long as you want. So, you know, I have no idea of slowing down or stepping away anytime soon.
So you've got that 2016 text chain. At any point in that text chain, are you getting hints that LeBron is coming back to Cleveland?
No. At least, he sometimes can, like we all can, like read like a cheap novel. Like, okay, we know what you're really saying here. Like, it was like after 2018, like, did you know he was going to the Lakers? I was like, I had some sort of an idea that was a possibility, like a strong possibility, I should say. But no, I don't see any, he obviously loves our makeup. He loves our team, has a special, bond with obviously Akron, the city of Cleveland, Ohio. But no, I don't really get a feel for that as of right now. But, with him, it can change.
You said it, though. Like, he's one of the smartest guys ever. And, yes. Like, pulling, like, Jason Lloyd away at the All-Star game is like, come on. Like, you're talking to, like, the guy, the face of Cleveland sports out there. One of the faces, and talking to him about that is, that's something.
That is. I mean, it's, Bron is going to, he's going to do things, his way. And again, that was funny to see. He's like, I wouldn't count that out. But, he also said like, wherever Bronny ends up going, I'm going to make sure that I'm going to find a way to go. It's like any team, like, is that really something that's going to happen? I mean, like, I think of, I grew up watching the Seattle Mariners. So when it was like, the Griffies up there, it's like, no, Seattle is an amazing, amazing place. There's certain places like where if Bronny ended up, I don't know if Bron would go and enjoy that there. But, you know, who am I? I'm projecting at this point, but that would be very cool to see. And would Bron come back here? I mean, I'm not counting it out either. I don't know. I don't know.
Never know. Never say never. You're working with Milkbone for this week. Being friendly with you, friendly with your wonderful fiance, Kate, I feel like I've seen your dog grow up like from puppyhood because Kate has been bombarding her followers with pictures of the dog. What are you doing with Milkbone right now?
We just, you know, like you said, we can't get enough of Vestry. She's amazing. She's like the quintessential Velcro dog, like all Vizslas are. And we, like Milkbone, celebrate dogs. So their birthday cake biscuit is launching. Vestry loves the product. She can't get enough of it. She lets us know. She's a very vocal dog. So again, that's why we're here today. We're celebrating all dogs, all their birthdays. And again, it's a special time to be a dog when you have stuff like this.
I've seen more pictures of you with a sleeping dog than I can see.
It's my soft post, man. I honestly, I never thought I'd be this guy, but again, I bring her to the facility. She, you know, when we go to the game and you know, I'm driving and you know, Kate drops me off. She's driving home. Vestry just jumps back in the car. She's right there. You know, we give our hugs and you know, I'll see her after the game. It's kind of, you know, that a companionship is unlike any other.
You got to love it. You got to love it. Kevin, good to talk to you, man. Congrats on all the success for the team and for you as well this year. I hope to catch up soon.
Chris, thank you.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it. Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.